Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is producer Rod Roddenberry. Rod, welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing, John? I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you.
Hey, great. It's nice to have you on the show. Just for the few listeners who may not know, you are the son of Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek, to set the stage. But the show's about you, of course. So, and you are, I am told, an official member of the Mac Observer family. And there's a whole story about that, about how you got into Macs and met the Mac Observer team and Macworld. And tell me about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I've been an Apple fan from day one. I think I had an Apple IIe or C, I can't remember, and then took a break. I was much, much younger. It was something my parents got me. But then when the 84 Macintosh came out, there's a story, actually, and I don't know how true this is, but that Steve Jobs gave one to my father, and he gave it to me. And I used it mostly for games and Mac Paint and Mac Write and some fun things like that.
Again, you're not the first person to mention Mac Paint as the ignition point.
It was a lot of fun. In fact, to take it back even a little further, my father told me about this new computer coming out called a Macintosh, and he told me of this concept of the mouse. And at that time, I don't know, what was fourth grade, whatever I was in, I thought it was ridiculous. I mean, just if you've never understood the concept of what a mouse is, and then someone says, well, it's this thing that you put your hand on and move around and it moves something on the screen, I don't know. But I feel foolish for not seeing the genius in it. Anyhow.
Was your vision different? Did you kind of feel like this is not the way we're going to interact with the computer, we're going to talk to them instead?
No, yeah, I wish I could say I was.
There's a classic scene in Star Trek IV where Scotty picks up the mouse, right, and tries to talk
computer.
To it.
Computer, yep. I wish I could say I was that forward-thinking, but as a fourth grader at the time, I don't think I was even thinking computers. But needless to say, I've loved Macs. I've had a 2SI. I've had so many Macs throughout my entire life, and I'm now standing in an office with three 27-inch monitors in front of me, one 24-inch behind me. Probably four Macs in this room, all running, doing different things. Don't ask why or what I'm doing. I have no idea what I'm doing. To move the story along, I started listening to podcasts, and there were a number of Mac podcasts that I love. MacCast was one of the first ones I started listening to.
Adam is our webmaster.
Yep. And Mac OS Ken, and of course, the Mac Geek Gab. I still listen to all of these, and I love them. And then I heard about the Mac World conventions, and I was like, wow, wait a second. I can go and meet people who love Macs just like me. So as a profession, I'll go to Star Trek conventions, and while it's still fun, it's still a little bit of work. This was my time to geek. This was me going up to San Francisco on my own and walking into the trade show floor and just, you know, all of these beautiful vendors showing cool Mac stuff. So I loved it. I got to meet some of these podcasters.
Was it your goal to kind of blend in without being recognized and just geek out?
Absolutely. I did not walk in wearing a Star Trek shirt or anything that said my father was just rotten. I just went around and I started meeting people, and one thing led to another, just became friends with essentially all you guys.
What were some of the companies that had a big impact on you that you really admired?
Oh, wow. Huh. That sounds so important. I'm just a gadget guy. Mm-hmm. So, and to a fault, where they say someone can be on the cutting edge of technology. Well, there's also the phrase being on the bleeding edge. I kind of get the first of everything. And most times the first of everything is still a beta. So most of the stuff I have breaks down. But anyhow, at these shows, I would go, and whether it was a battery to charge something or a new case for an iPad or whatever it was, those were the things that I really loved. And, you know, some of them have stuck with me, and some of them, you know, a couple months later, I was like, okay, eBay.
You said you have a bunch of Macs in your office. Do you have iPads and iPhones floating around too?
I do. I've got one iPhone, and I've got an iPad. So I've got my three monitors all out in front of me, and then an iPad on a movable arm right up above. And I use that because we have Nest cameras throughout the house. And in my office here, I'm sort of away from the gate in the front door, and I can kind of monitor what's going on if someone comes up to the front door or anything like that.
What kind of an iPad is it? I fell in love with the big 12.9 because I thought iPads should be bigger.
Uh-huh. I have a 12.9 as my personal. Mm-hmm. This is just the, what is this, the 7, what do they call it, 7.9 or
10? 9.7 inch iPad 9. Pro.
9.7? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just here. And it just has a very simple function. I bought it on eBay. I think it's a few generations back because it just doesn't need to do much.
How do you feel about the future of iPads versus your Macs?
You know, I'm not one of the... I believe the OS will come together at some point, but I would hate for my computer to work like my iPad. I think an iPad is limited. Maybe I'm just older, but I still want a keyboard and a mouse or a trackpad of some sort.
Mm-hmm. You're not alone. You're not alone.
Oh, yeah. I don't know what the merger is going to be and what it's going to look like, but I would hate to lose the functionality of my desktop, what that allows me, and just sort of go to an iPad. I hear about those people like, yeah, no, I don't use a laptop anymore. I just use my iPad. I think they're crazy. I mean, how can they possibly do that? You know, they must only browse the internet or something.
Yeah. Have you seen?
Let's be judgmental, but it just sounds crazy.
Have you seen the new Microsoft Studio, the like 25-inch iPad that slants back and you can lean over and touch it? And
I saw a few images. Yeah,
it's an amazing device. I first ran across sort of a novel concept that I liked in the TV show Terra Nova, where in the science and med lab, they had these big, beautiful, like meter-wide glass panels where the image was floating on the glass. And I thought, wow, this is the future. What kind of operating system? Who knows? But
when I
saw
that
Microsoft Studio, I thought, well, we're sort of getting there. We're getting there.
Yeah, no, I love that. You said Terra Nova, and that's the dinosaur one, right?
That's the one where the team goes back in time.
Okay, we don't need to discuss that one.
Okay.
But they had cool technology.
They did.
Yeah. So, I love the idea of a glass. You know, one of the reasons why I listen to the podcast is because I love the speculation and the rumors and, you know, what's the next iPhone. And I know everyone gets kind of sick of, you know, a year before it comes out, these rumors starting to spread and validity of these things. You know, you don't know where they've come from. But I love that idea of, Corning Glass. Do you know Corning Glass?
They're the people who make the Gorilla Glass for Apple.
Yeah. Right? They did a video a few years back, and I forgot the name of it, but it was like a Corning Future, and it shows this guy waking up out of bed, and of course, the shade's automatically going up, and on all the windows, there's information on weather, and he goes in to brush his teeth, and on the mirror there's information, and he can look up his calendar.
You can buy one of those. We did a cool stuff found on that. It's a mirror that hangs in your bathroom that's really a display. And you connect it to your phone, and it throws up the calendar. So while you're brushing your teeth, you can see your events for the day.
Gadget. There's a gadget. Yeah. Sounds expensive, but there's a gadget.
Yeah.
But it's a great video. I highly recommend anyone who hasn't seen it, go to YouTube, look up Corning Glass, search for the word future. And it's just that's where I want to live.
Do you engage in home automation? Do you have an Echo?
I do. I have Echoes throughout the house. I love them. I'm right now. I'm really torn because these things all need to play together well, and they don't. So you've got Amazon's Echo, which has got its own system. You've got the Android Smart Things. You got the Wemos. I've got Wemos, and of course you've got iHome. You've got the Apple version of that, and it doesn't all necessarily play well together. And you have to kind of select one and then dive in all the way. And that's driving me insane.
So did your fascination for Macs sort of stem out of was the first one? Or did you sort of feel like, this was a step ahead when everybody else was using DOS and you just felt like Apple's got it and nobody else does? How did that happen?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm all about everything in life should be user-friendly. Things shouldn't complicate life. Life is complicated on its own. Whether it's children, family, life, love, work, life is complicated. You shouldn't have anything that clutters that. And something that makes it easier or can at least alleviate some of the stress, that's a good product for me.
Yeah, we have that vision. You're right. You're exactly right. We have that vision of getting up in the morning and the shades open and we're brushing our teeth and looking at our calendar in the mirror, and then we're sitting down and having a conversation with our computer. But in real life, it doesn't always go so smoothly. You have to put a lot of work into it to kind of maintain it. You know, when you, especially when you have three or four Macs and an iPad, and new versions of the operating system come out, and you got to update all the machines, and then you find out, oops, you shouldn't have updated that one because there was a chance it could have been bricked.
Yep.
And then you kind of go, well, maybe I should wait a while. And then you find yourself spending too much time attending to these issues. It shouldn't have to be that way.
It shouldn't. It should just be part of your day. And that would be one of the things. And you know, listen, the user has to take some responsibility. I clutter my life with some of this technology because I might be running a beta of something, or because I'm using it in a way it wasn't really meant for. So you know, I got to take some responsibility for it. But it'll be nice when everything just works smoothly together.
Now, you grew up sort of enamored with Apples and Apple IIs and Macs, but I've been told that you were not really, you know, hanging around the set of Star Trek all the time, and were not that involved with it. That came later, right?
Yeah, you know, my father really sort of had two lives. I did a documentary in 2011 called Trek Nation, mm-hmm. where I kind of did an exploration of who Gene Roddenberry was, the man and the myth behind Star Trek. And, you know, I learned he had sort of his Star Trek family, and then he had his home family. So when he went into the office, you know, he had all the people there. And when I interviewed a lot of those people, you know, they shared so many great stories, and so many of them said, you know, he was kind of like a father to me. And, you know, through this process, when I was much younger, it was a little point of contention with me, a little jealousy I went through. But then I just learned that I had all these brothers and sisters out there, which is fantastic. So my father never brought Star Trek home, and he rarely brought me into Star Trek. I was doing my own thing. It was Starsky and Hutch, Knight Rider, playing with my friends, chasing girls, whatever it was at the time. That's what I was into. It wasn't until he passed away that I was kind of like opened to the philosophy of Star Trek and how it actually affected people and influenced people in a positive way. And I became very proud of my father at that point, and very proud of what the Roddenberry name meant mm-hmm. to a lot of people. So I started to pursue it. And then over the years, really fell in love with that philosophy of a better future, and have made it sort of my drive to in my own way contribute to that better future.
Now your mom was Majel Barrett.
Yep.
And she was on the original series as Nurse Chapel.
Yep.
And then later she was in the Star Trek Next Generation series as Luxana Troi.
Mm-hmm.
Was she always on the studio floor too, or did you spend more time with her?
Well, see, not to complicate it, but, you know, I was born in 1974. So I was born years after the original series came out and then was canceled. And my mother and father got married in 1969, and they were dating beforehand during the original series. So during the original series, of course, she had a presence there as Nurse Chapel. And actually, in the cage, she was number one. She was the first officer.
Yeah, that's a whole discussion right there about female leadership.
Yeah, that's a whole
leadership.
Other one, yeah. Yep, yep. Ahead of its time, but maybe not that far ahead of its time.
Well, they solved that problem later with the starship captain in Voyager.
They did. But, of course, the executives at the time said, you know, listen, you gotta lose the woman second in command, and the guy with the pointy ears has got to go, too. And my father was able to negotiate. His cute story,
Thank
whether
goodness.
It really went this way or not, was he negotiated to keep Spock in and then married the woman. So that's his cute sort of way of sharing story. I'm not sure how people feel about it. But
well, I can tell you a personal story about that, because I was an undergraduate when Star Trek aired. And I was a geek, and I was an astrophysics major. And
wow.
I was hanging around with some very geeky people, you know, struggling with our astronomy and astrophysics, and feeling kind of nerdy and geeky and using circular slide rules. And my girlfriend, friends were started calling me Mr. Spock, because I was so quiet, and, you know, I was kind of tall and lanky and wore certain kinds of clothing. And Mr. Spock provided an anchor I mean, mm-hmm. he was somebody to idolize. He was somebody to admire. He was somebody to embrace and give validity to what you were trying to do. And he also sort of punctuated and validated your emotional struggles to be the calm, cool scientist when everybody else was, you know, throwing footballs and having parties.
Right.
So it was a real stabilizing influence on the technical youth at a time when we were on our way to the moon and technology was blossoming and we had the Concorde and Apollo missions. And so Leonard Nimoy was an enormous influence, as you know, on people who gave the first grand respectability to geekdom.
No, that's awesome. You know, to know that Star Trek was one of the factors that made being smart or studying or having an education cool. That's huge. I mean, from just a science fiction TV show to something that really changed people's lives for the better in many ways.
Yeah, another thing that was interesting about that is that Kirk, to some extent, and Spock to a complete extent, had full mastery of the ship. He understood everything. He could go under the display and open up a board and go in there with wires, and he could rewire the ship, and he could fix things like Scotty. And there was that sense that you had the responsibility to just know everything. And as a young science major, that was the onus on us. I mean, there was just no acceptable answer for not knowing the speed of light to 5 decimal places if you were a physics student, right?
So, right. That is awesome.
That was important also for us to have that role model. And you don't see that too much these days, except maybe on Scorpion, where they know everything too.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's funny that influenced your childhood. I did not grow up with Star Trek, so I was a little bit more of a goof off in school and didn't really work hard until I was much, much older. But I was trying to think, where were we talking about? Well, one last thing on Spock. Adam Nimoy, his son, did a great documentary called For the Love of Spock that just came out this year, a few months back. And for your listeners out there, I highly recommend you check it out on Netflix or whatever your choice of viewing is.
Okay, cool. Well, that's a good time for us to take a break. So, folks, we'll be right back in 60 seconds, and then we'll talk to Rod Roddenberry about some of his current projects. Folks, stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thanks, Kelly. I'm chatting with Rod Roddenberry. Rod, today you are a producer and CEO of Roddenberry Entertainment. What does that involve? What are you doing there?
Well, I haven't really followed in my father's footsteps in terms of taking over Star Trek necessarily or becoming a big Hollywood producer-writer. I've dabbled in that area, and I'm not cut out for it. You know, it's a cutthroat business, and maybe I grew up too spoiled, whatever it may be, but I'm a little simpler. I like to, anytime I work with someone, I like to believe what they say and trust they're going to do what they're going to do and not say something different or stab me in the back. And while the industry has tons of great people, it also has tons that are not so great. And I had some experience working on a show called Earth Final Conflict.
And, oh, I love that show. You know, I've written about that show so many times because of one thing, the little fold-out smartphone.
Yeah. It was a pretty unique concept. I mean, it was similar to V, where visitors came to Earth, but it was still very unique in its look, and it had a pretty good first season. But, you know, Hollywood politics kind of got in the way of it, and it was rewritten and changed, and main characters were switched out, and all sorts of things happened.
I found it hard to find on TV back in the old days. It's disappeared. Moved to late night shows or something.
Yeah, and it's really disappeared. Anyhow, the Canadians were awesome. I was in Toronto, and I loved working with everyone there. It was sort of the American distributors who made me rethink being in the industry. Anyhow, so what does it mean? Sorry, what does it mean to be a Roddenberry Entertainment? So we do all sorts of entertainment projects, everything from comic books to documentaries to short films. Of course, we're out there pitching ideas for television and theatrical, but of course, it is it's a tough business for anyone. So we hopefully will have something going one day in the mainstream TV and theatrical realm. Of course, I am working on the next Star Trek TV series, but my association is really sort of an executive producer, and that can be anything from, you know, just making comments and notes on scripts to running the ship. And right now, I'm not running the ship. I'm commenting on the stories that are coming through and trying to make sure that they retain sort of the Star Trek philosophy. And I'm proud to say and happy to say that the team writing the show right now is doing an excellent job of that.
I have a jackpot question for you.
Sure.
So it's my perception that in the days of Star Trek and Star Trek Next Generation and Voyager and Deep Space Nine, there was this pervasive Star Trek meme about the positive aspects of human nature and the good prospects for humanity moving forward, that we would solve a lot of tough technical issues, that we would deal with climate change, we would start populating the galaxy and move out and secure our species, and there was hope for the future. And then Deep Space Nine and Voyager went off the air. We had Enterprise for a while, but there was a long period of gap between the last Enterprise and now coming up the next TV show. Mm-hmm. The Star Trek Discovery, right? And during that time, it seems to me like, it's just my perception, that we kind of lost that sense of hope for humanity, and things became kind of less optimistic. And there's been that absence of the Star Trek supporting role in our culture. How do you feel about that?
I don't disagree with you. I think... So I grew up with the Next Generation. I know a majority of people listening to this who like Star Trek are probably going to be TOS people. And I think TOS was a great show. It was a little bit more raw. Captain Kirk did throw a punch, you know, fairly quickly, but he also was fairly intelligent and tried to solve things without violence often.
He also did his best to populate the galaxy.
Yes, he did. Yes, that's... Yes, he was known. He was known pretty well for that. So Next Gen is, I think, a unique one. It's one where
it's my
we
favorite.
Are a better human species. We're a better people. We are not sort of bogged down by some of our current day and our current day issues of fear of diversity and fear of change and not being tolerant and accepting of new ideas. That was a future where we had evolved to a point where we were seeking the universe not for weird-looking aliens, but we were seeking them for new ideas. We were seeking for species out there who looked at the universe in a different way, and we thought, maybe we can learn something from this. Even if we disagree, it'll give us some sort of range to explore the thought processes out there and appreciate the diversity in thought in our universe. So I really loved that. I really loved that it was a crew who got along and there wasn't a lot of conflict. Later on, there was much more conflict.
Yeah. Well, you know, conflict is important for the viewing audience and for theatrics. Mm-hmm. And you see that a little bit in the current National Geographic series, Mars, which is awesome, by the way.
I haven't seen it. I've heard about it, but
I highly recommend it. It's
all right.
One of the things that's good about it is that it presents an optimistic view of moving outward finally. You know, we went through phases. There was the first phase, what I call the first phase of Mars, where we thought it would be like the moon. We would send three men and three women. They'd land on Mars. They'd plant the flag. They'd take some pictures, and then they'd come home. Take 6 months to do that, too. Mm-hmm. And then we went through phase two, where we realized that... You know, we needed a lot more infrastructure and technology. We needed to send fueling stations and equipment beforehand. And and then people would arrive. They would have a place to live. And now I think we're kind of in the third phase where we're realizing that we need robot assistance, Android assistance. We need a lot of technology mm-hmm. assistance for us to go to Mars to thrive and to be able to make sure we, you know, if the Earth civilization were to pass away, the species would survive on another colony. And this is just the start of moving outward. So we've gone through these phases. One of the things about Mars series that I thought was disappointing was we didn't see any androids. And I don't think we can go to Mars without robot assistance. But otherwise, it's a really great series. And it's sort of a resurgence of that optimism of moving out. But there's always that, you know, aspect of, can we afford it? Is it worthwhile? Mm-hmm, you know, there has to be that overriding inspiration. And that's where good science fiction comes in, right? Where it inspires us and says, we want to do this. You know, go find the money. This is important enough to do. Shouldn't right. just sit back and say, well, it's not worth doing. People might die. It's too expensive. You know, that's not the right approach.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I'm going to lose a lot of your listeners right now when they find out that while I love space and I am a supporter of it, I'm not one of the people who says, you know, at all costs, our first and foremost priority needs to be, you know, colonizing and getting out into space. Now, I'm not saying I don't believe in it, and I'm not saying we shouldn't have a space program. Where the place I'm coming from is, as our species needs a lot of work. You know, the United States, all countries, we all need to intellectually evolve a bit more. You know, I think at the same time we can be branching out into space, but I'm just not one of those diehards who just wants to do it at all costs. So I really sort of want us to sort of work on our humanity a bit. Because yeah. God forbid, if we ever meet another intelligent life form out there, I think if we had the technology to go to a planet today that was inhabited by, just say, a lower life form, I'm concerned we would fight over that planet and probably, in the process, harm or destroy the life on that planet.
But you know,
turn it into a resource.
We have come a long way. I was watching a Science Channel show a while back about hunters in the 1900s who would go out and kill wolves because wolves were killing livestock. Mm-hmm. And they would hang them up on racks by the shed, and they would just gloat over the fact that they were killing wolves. Now look at all the trouble we go to preserve species, and we tag them and we protect them. And our attitude about it is greatly advanced. So there is some hope in that respect.
Absolutely. I'm not saying we're all horrible people. I think we have made tremendous strides in all of those fronts. I just think our species as a whole, you know, needs to work on its appreciation of the planet and each other and the diversity between us in thought and in form.
If we can't respect each other's diversity on the same planet, how are we going to respect diversity when we run into the aliens?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
So you also have formed the Roddenberry Foundation. Tell me about that. What is its mission?
So something I'm very proud of is the foundation. We started in 2010. And, you know, this idea of a better future where we appreciate the differences between us and we thirst and crave for new ideas. And we work towards a future that incorporates everyone and gives everyone a better future. I wanted to do that with our family foundation. So what we do is we go out and we find organizations, institutions, and individuals who are working towards the long-term advancement of our species. People who are coming up with the next technology or the next medicine or whatever, or methodology even. Education, science, humanitarian advances, the environment, anyone who's trying to make the world a better place, not with a Band-Aid solution, but something long-term. So these are things that we might see in 5, 10, 20, 50 years. One of the organizations that we contributed, made a donation to, was the Gladstone Institute in San Francisco. And they're a medical institute, and they work with stem cell research. And these are the pluripotent stem cells. These are stem cells that are reverse engineered from any cell on the human body. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so what really sold me was, you know, we did a lot of due diligence. And when we were there visiting, they you know, showed me a microscope. And I looked at the microscope and I saw a sheet of beating heart cells. And what I learned was this sheet of beating heart cells was cultivated from a human male skin cell. And right then and there, the implications blew my mind. They were able to reverse engineer it into a stem cell and then program that stem cell to become heart cells and then to duplicate.
Does that mean the prospects for heart transplants without a tissue rejection are much better?
Exactly. I mean, in theory, what can happen is once they get the once they're able to structure these things and create them, and they've done certain people have already done certain things, scaffoldings in the throats and stuff like that. But you will not reject it because it's made of your own tissue. And one of the other things they can do more immediately is drug testing. You can get, if you have a liver issue, whatever it may be, if they can get a sample, they can of your skin, they can turn it to your liver, create a number of dishes in that, and then test the medicines on that liver because people are affected by these medicines in different ways.
Yeah, there's so much witchcraft.
And so you don't have to suffer through that, right?
Yeah, there's so much witchcraft now where it's like, let's try this and see if it works, but we're just at the beginning of DNA matching and testing. Yes, yes.
Fabulous. Yeah. So anyone who's out there doing stuff like that, we also just launched the Roddenberry Prize, which just actually finished in November. But it was along the same ideas. We're inviting anyone out there, individual or institution, who's got a great idea for the future, something that's well thought out and developed. They can submit it to us. We've got a team of 8 judges.
You have some distinguished judges on that panel.
Yes, we do. 8 judges who have been going over our thousands of applications and sort of reviewing them and narrowing them down. And in the end, they will choose a winner for a $1 million prize.
Awesome. Let us know about that. Yeah. I'll put it in the show notes. That's going to be great. We're almost out of time here, but there's one more thing I want to ask you about.
Sure.
I am told that you have a very keen interest in protecting the oceans.
Absolutely.
Tell me more about that.
I've been an avid scuba diver since 1993. Where does that put me now? A long time. 20
years.
Some odd years.
Yeah.
23 years. Okay. And I just, the idea of going into space, as much as I just told you that I'm not one of the huge proponents, I still love the idea of exploring new planets and seeing alien life. You can do that here on Earth. You can put a spacesuit on, a dive suit. You can put a breathing apparatus on. And you can go into a world that is so different. And I know anyone listening who's been snorkeling or diving, they might think I'm overselling this, but it really is. You are seeing alien life. You are in an environment that, well, you're a fish out of water, but you're a human in water. And you can have some of the most exhilarating experiences. And the diversity of life and the diversity of structure in plant life down there. California is so much different than Hawaii, is so much different than Massachusetts.
Well,
so much
it's also important that we understand the food chain in the ocean, too, because
absolutely.
As the water changes and the acidity changes, the water temperature levels and so on, the lower level organisms, the krill and so on, are going to be affected. And that works its way up through the food chain and the food we eat from the ocean. So we got to understand that.
You are 100%. And one of the biggest issues right now, I mean, there's so many issues is the problem, but plastics, every piece of plastic trash that we have that might blow onto the floor, that goes into a storage drain, that works its way into the ocean, it eventually always gets broken up into all these micro pieces. Those micro pieces are eaten by not just birds, but fish. And then bigger fish eat that and bigger fish eat that. And then we eat the big fish.
Mm-hmm.
And they have found small amounts of plastics in umbilical cords.
Human.
We have plastics in our body from from consuming fish. And over time, that is going to build up and be a huge problem for us.
Do you think there's a time when we can no longer farm the sea at all?
Well, here's what I love. One of the organizations that we're supporting with the foundation is called Modern Meadows, and a few of these others have popped up, and they are growing synthetic meats. They are using not exactly the pluripotent stem cell thing, but they are using certain methods like that where they can grow meat in a dish. And eventually this will be meat hanging from a rack somewhere that will be grown. And we will be going to the store and we will be eating these meats that are not from living animals anymore, which I'm a huge hypocrite because I love animals, but I'm still a meat eater. So I feel horrible. I never judge people on that. But won't it be great when we're not farming fish, when we're not farming cattle, when we're not farming any of these things? They're being grown in a vertical farm in a building somewhere.
Yeah, it's sort of like a technical way of getting a grip on our food supply and cleaning it up a little bit, maybe.
Absolutely. And this may all sound like sci-fi, but it's not. This is happening. The problem that's right now is cost and scaling.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, but that's always going to be solved. We know that in technology, it just things get more affordable and easier to scale.
Cool. Well, we're about out of time. Do you have any closing thoughts you want to leave with us?
No, this is great. I thought we were going to talk more about Max, and I'm glad we didn't, because as much as a geek as I am, I don't know if I know anything more than your listeners already know. So all I can say is I love the shows you guys do. Please keep up the good work. I love Cool Stuff Found.
All right.
I'll always be a listener.
All right. Excellent. I'm glad to hear that. We'll keep up the good work. And thanks again for being on the show. It's been delightful. Thank you for telling us your story, Rod. And I love hearing from you. So
thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right. Folks, I hope you enjoyed the show, too. Thank you for coming by and listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. We'll see you next week.